today we are going to be reviewing Pax Romana by Jonathan Hickman and Frankenstein's Womb by Warren Ellis and Marek Olasicki. We're going to start with Pax Romana by Jonathan Hickman. And this is essentially a sci-fi story set in the future where the Catholic Church discovers the technology to travel back in time and decides to go back in time and right the wrongs against the Catholic Church. And it goes awry from there. Essentially, you have the general ends up taking over fairly quickly, and they decide to, instead of righting the wrongs against the Catholic Church, really move humanity forward and society forward at an accelerated pace so that instead of having the Dark Ages, we kind of just skip over the Dark Ages and really move along society, move society forward and introduce things like the scientific method and stuff. And what was really interesting about this is that for a story like that, there's really not much action. It's really Jonathan Hickman-esque.
For as much action as happened in this, there was very little actual action on the page. This story focuses so much on the politicking behind a massive invasion force that the battles are almost an afterthought, and Hickman's design and layout and artwork really lends itself to that.
I think, though, that that's necessary, especially when you've got a fighting force from the future. I mean, they're just going to annihilate anybody, so there's no question who's going to win in a battle. And it's the politicking behind the scenes of really melding this world together into their own vision that is what is of interest and the actual challenge. I mean, they could rule the world with a small fighting force, you know, with futuristic technology or even with modern technology now. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think that that's getting to the sort of heart of the plot of the piece, is that the Vatican puts together an army, a technically superior army that is going to go back into the past, and it sounds like, and it's never exactly clear if it's the actual desire of the Catholic Church or if it's the desire of Cardinal Pelle, who ends up running this, at least initially, if the desire is to change events at a fundamental level and exert a real direct impact on it. In other words, go back and right some wrongs.
Mm-hmm.
Or, as Cardinal Pelle ends up revealing, at least his plan, is to go back and instead defend the Catholic Church to the best of their ability. And so it's not so much exert a direct impact, it's more that they're just going to make sure that nothing bad happens to the Catholic Church and keep out, you know, the invading Huns and people that, you know, caused about the decline of Western civilization and caused the Dark Ages and such.
But his focus wasn't really to prevent the Dark Ages from happening, because it seems to me that that's where the general Nicholas Chase really steps in and wants to change things, is because he really sees this as an opportunity to essentially jumpstart the Enlightenment.
Right. He sees it as skipping everything bad that's ever happened by going in and nipping it all in the bud.
Yeah.
And basically looking at, you know, from the point of view of history of, okay, well, I know how this story all plays out. I know where all the players will be throughout time.
Uh-huh.
And so stopping them before they can get to that point in time. And you're right. So he wants to take an entirely different approach, which is to basically create utopia then.
Not really utopia, though, because he takes a very pragmatic approach to it, in that he's still keeping slaves and different things of the past, and he's not just jumping straight into a utopia. He doesn't expect that to happen right away. He's really more for going through the natural progressions of societies and governments that we've gone through, but at an accelerated pace.
They were looking at every three generations revolution. And them being the catalyst of the revolution each time, and basically being the politics with a K, behind it. You know, the people that were going to be the ones that were pulling all the strings.
Yeah.
And so that was really an interesting dichotomy, that you had two different views here. That the people that were going to go back and basically just be a buffer zone, a superior force.
Which I didn't really understand that point of view. Like, I don't understand why you would even want that. You've got this, you know, this massive chance to change history, and all you're going to do is just sit there and be a buffer against...
Well, they were going to be superior. And if you take a look at the history of the church, that... there were those who were, and there were those who weren't. And if you were, then you got the glories of heaven. And if you weren't, you were, you know, a heathen. You were going to fry in hell. And so this would be a perfect opportunity for them to go and have this superiority, not just a moral superiority that they saw, but also a physical superiority that they saw, that would allow them to basically... have people flocking to them. It would be something where people would come to them for their protection.
I get it.
And what I thought was interesting about it is that this early idea mirrors, or parallels, I guess, the Crusades. That what happened with the Crusades is there was a real perceived threat of an overwhelming force of Islam coming up and destroying not the Vatican in Rome, but actually it was the Eastern Orthodox Church in Constantinople. And so there, and you notice in the book, they talked about maybe they should go back to the Great Schism, and that was the split between the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. Or maybe they should go back to the time of the Crusades. All of this sort of mirrors the Crusades, because what ended up happening is the emperor of the Byzantine Empire, the emperor, went and asked the Pope, the Catholic Pope, for an armed fighting force to help him defend Constantinople. And push back this invading Muslim force. And what ended up happening was the Pope saw this as a great opportunity to do that and then some more. And he raised this massive army that was technologically superior to anything that had been done before. This is the First Crusade. And basically sent them to the Middle East, sent them to Constantinople, and told them along the way that anything they did gave them a free ticket into heaven. And that's exactly what these mercenaries in Pax Romana are being told.
Yeah.
You know, they're being told that they get a free pass to heaven. They just have to convert to Catholicism. And Hickman goes so far as to have the cardinal, once they arrive, say in his final words are, "God wills it."
Yeah.
And that's what Pope Urban II said when he called for the First Crusade. He cried, "Deus le vult," or, you know, "It's the will of God. God wills it that we do this." And so I just thought that, wow, this is a really interesting idea. And the First Crusade, you know, all three Crusades were pretty much failures. The First Crusade managed to retake the Holy Land, but, you know, it crumbled within, you know, under 100 years. This is kind of the whole idea that, okay, what if we sent a really technical superior force and one that could maintain it?
Yeah.
And so that, I thought, was just a really neat look at history and really learning from history and going back. But even then, the best laid plans of mice and men, they go back and it all crumbles anyways.
But it crumbles for the better if you're not Catholic.
You think it crumbles for the better?
Oh, definitely.
Why do you say that?
They advance society. Yeah. They accomplish the goals of the general's mission.
I don't know. I have a hard time.
I think the Dark Ages were a horrible point in history, and they completely skipped that era of history and moved past it.
I can see that, but I think that, you know, what they were aiming for was a better society, and what I think they ended up with was a society that was even more manipulative and even more controlled than what they were going for. Does that make sense?
I think that the whole point was that they were moving beyond the source of religion as a power base,
mm-hmm.
and moving towards you could believe in anything and no, there's no dominant belief system here. And right. All they were doing was using government as a catalyst to get and move into the Enlightenment and beyond.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting point, because they got together, they showed the gathering at Nicaea to try to figure out, historically it was when they basically codified the Bible and decided what was going to be there and what wasn't. And in this history, it was a discussion between fundamentalism and Catholicism.
Uh-huh.
And the Emperor Constantine basically steps in and says both are going to be fine and both are going to be state function. Now let's move on. Yeah. Or state supported. And that was, like you said, I mean, that was a great time that government stepped in and said this will not be an issue, this will not be a problem. And, you know, how it allowed the society to move on to bigger problems or bigger issues.
Yeah, and that's where I saw it as a success.
Mm-hmm. But I think that I never saw it moving past any of the big social problems. I mean, yeah, they jump-started technology, but all the social ills were still there.
I guess the problem is that we don't really see what society is like on Mars, as we find out later that's where the new Pope, or the, what do they call him, the Gene Pope?
The Gene Pope and the Emperor live.
Yeah. And so we don't know really how it concludes. We only see the process.
But within 1,000 years of the time we end this, you know, by the time we leave our main characters, 1,000 years later, they're on New Rome on Mars. And I couldn't quite tell how to take that. I couldn't tell if that was that they had moved and now, you know, society had jumped to the point where they could establish their own utopia there, or that in 1,000 years they had screwed up the world below so badly because you had the detonation of all four nuclear devices.
I think that that's the great part of this ending. You really get to build the end in your mind.
Yeah,
I really saw it as a leap forward as we mm-hmm. see the moon landing. I mean, that's one of the greatest achievements of man that our society sees.
Right.
Is the landing of man on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see it as the landing of Mars and the colonization of Mars as that next great step. And I think that that was the point. I mean, that's my assumption.
Right.
Your assumption that, you know, maybe Earth is completely screwed up and that's why we're colonizing Mars.
That was
just as valid, I suppose.
You know, and that was the thing. And I think I read this as a fairly pessimistic book, because I also looked at things like when we're introduced to the Emperor Constans IV. It says here that he assumed the throne at the age of 4, and I'm trying to think what it was, but the number of emperors that had, I mean, what the death toll of the emperors was along the way, but it was like, how many of them? 72 or something. I mean, it was a ridiculous number. How fast they died and how few of them died of natural causes.
I think even with the most optimistic of outcomes, it's still a very pessimistic book because it's basically saying that without a bloodthirsty, single-minded person behind, you know, the curtain pulling strings, that man will never progress to this stage in a way that he could. And without that 20/20 hindsight, there's no way for man to progress in a way that they could.
Yeah.
In the best way possible, or the quickest, the most efficient way possible. And I think that that's the most pessimistic thing that this book is describing.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like there were so many opportunities to bring so many positive things here to the past, and what they chose, or at least what they ended up with, was military force to create all the change. They went back with, I'm trying to think how many metric tons of gold. I mean, more than the empire had at the time, even though they said they'd be pretty limited. I mean, when you're dealing in metric tons of gold, you're doing pretty well. They went back with the accumulated knowledge and history of the world, and they end up, the only thing we ever hear about them introducing is one of them comes in and makes a comment about how he'd introduced the scientific method to a group of philosophers, which I thought was kind of a cool idea. Yeah. But you think with all this ability to bring back limitless wealth, to bring back the accumulated knowledge of the world, and what is it they choose to employ? It's
I don't think
violence
that,
and mayhem.
I don't think it's a choice. I think that that is the way that it has to be done. With an iron fist, that's the only way that you can change the progression of man. I think that that was the point that he was trying to say.
Is through revolution and violence.
Yeah.
I see, but I look at the end of the book, on the very end of the book, after the story, there is a 5-page timeline here that talks about the split of the three kingdoms, if you will. You've got Rome going through the middle, you have Britain up at the top, and you have Africa at the bottom. And you look at the histories of Rome and Britain, and it's battle and bloodshed and assassination attempt and this and that and the other. You look at what happened in Africa during all this time, and it's, you know, first engineering school in Alexandria, printing press and portable watch, 12-month calendar, African Council of Kings. While each regional kingdom continues to function as a monarchy, the council operates as a democratic body. So you've got the introduction of democracy. Going on to the next page, first microscope constructed in Alexandria, calculus invented. So you've got all these things happening in Africa, while up above you've got the Templars detonate their last functioning nuclear weapon in Gaul, killing 300,000 Roman citizens. The resultant outrage accelerates revolution in Rome. And so you've got all these things happening up in, you know, the upper part of our flowchart here that are violence and bloodshed and mayhem and all these other things, whereas Africa, where violence is not part of it, or at least that not that we're seeing on this chart.
Yeah.
And it is developing the scientific and democratic principles that I think they were trying to achieve. And I think that's another reason why I just saw it as so negative or so pessimistic. It's not to say that I didn't enjoy the hell out of this book, because I really did. I'm just saying that I found the message in this to be that, you know, all these people, they go back with all this limitless wealth, limitless knowledge, at least compared to what there was there.
Sure.
And they end up going back to the most basic of things, which is killing people.
Well, I think that's also to be expected when you have military people in charge.
Yeah, but he wasn't supposed to be in charge. Yeah. He was supposed to have, on the other side, the balance that he was supposed to have the moral rudder, if you will, of the church. And that was gone by the end of the first chapter.
Taken out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So how did you feel about the pacing?
You know, I really enjoyed it. I thought that the pacing of the book was fantastic. There was a ton that of exposition that you had to get through. I mean, you had to have not just one world built for you, because we're starting off in the future of 54 or something.
Uh-huh.
So we're already starting off in a future that doesn't necessarily resemble our own. Uh-huh. I mean, we're dealing with genetics and all sorts of stuff right off the bat. And then we have to have another world that we understand as well created for us.
Yeah.
And this is the historical world, which is a pretty complex place.
And not only that, but it's really important that we understand the characters that are driving this story forward, because it really depends on their characterization as to how the whole story ends up.
That's right. You have to understand how all these people work and feel about each other and about what's going on.
And they had a really complex, dynamic relationship that made sense and seemed realistic. And it was amazing to me that he was able to do that, even though there are several pages, where it's nothing but conversation.
Right.
Between them, it was interesting to me to hear them discussing among themselves, like, what was going to take place. And so I didn't feel like it was too much, even though it's two whole pages of nothing but text.
And it's not just two whole pages, it's multiple times throughout the book that it's two mm-hmm. whole pages of text. And I think that that's what's so amazing about this, is that it flows so quickly. I mean, really, this is the kind of book that you can sit down and read it in one sitting. It is not overwhelming. You'll find yourself stopping to put it down to kind of digest it
yeah.
because there is so much, but it's not the kind of thing that's overwhelming to you.
Once he gets past describing the future world and the past world and gives some character development, then the story really it flows pretty fast.
Right. No, I agree. And I think that, again, he doesn't rely on having the big battle scenes to move us along. He's got us moving along through actual story development.
Yeah.
And that's big. And we're dealing with lots of time here. We're dealing with almost 100 years worth of lifespan of the characters that we're dealing with. So I think that that's another thing, is he moves it along while still allowing these personal things to shine through and develop.
The plot was very carefully crafted to leave out enough and highlight enough to where we could understand what was going on and it was still interesting.
Right. And the dialogue did a great job of that. The dialogue it was expository enough that you got what you needed, but it wasn't overly, preachy and talk down to you. I mean, an offhanded comment about, look, we haven't been in the same room in 3 years. Let's not start fighting now. Was enough to tell us it's been 3 years since they've gone through. Or, Uncle Nicky, that kind of thing, where we see now that Flavio's got 4 kids.
Yeah.
And, and they're all old enough. So, again, we get these little bits to help us move along in the time without it having to be all the text. And then when it is text, it's important and, it's transcripts of conversations.
Yeah. It was very interesting. And to go back to the dialogue, I felt like every character had a distinct voice. Without it being hokey or really cartoony, you know.
Right.
Or cliche.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Yeah, the people, I got the real feeling from the sort of alternate future that we start the book in, that it's a much more global society that we're dealing in.
Definitely.
That a lot of the nationalism issues had broken down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was more of a united world culture. It wasn't there yet, but it was more of one.
I agree.
And so it allowed for you to have different different political and global points of view without, having to resort to funky accents or whatever.
So what did you think of the art?
Fans of Hickman's art are going to be happy with this. You know, I like Hickman's art to an extent. Mm-hmm. I think that there are some absolutely beautiful pages in here. It has a lot of the stylistic tics, though, that I had a problem with when I read Nightly News, which is that this is, as opposed to necessarily being a art book, it's a design book.
Yeah.
I just have the feeling that I'm looking at a series of static images on a page that are designed beautifully. I mean, the pages are designed, but I have a hard time calling it art. I have a hard time calling it a visual narrative, if that makes sense.
I kind of understand it. The art jumps. It's not like in Asterius Polyp where it flowed a very natural conversation and body language through a conversation. It's very much, it jumps from this scene and there's one static image of this scene to the next scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so there isn't that visual narrative that you think of when you think of comic books. But I think that that's where it's unique and that's what I enjoy about it. Right. Because he captures a lot through the space that he's not using for other panels.
Right, and like I said, since he's not trying necessarily to convey too much action, it's more important that we get a full understanding of who people are that are speaking it, their body language as they're speaking it, and the emotion. And he does a great job conveying emotion through faces and body and all.
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, the art in this, his art is very good. Like I said, I just have, I mean, my own stylistic preference is that I just feel like this book is designed heavily. It's not as heavily designed as the Nightly News was. That one just drove me nuts. But
I absolutely love it, and so I disagree, but I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
My favorite page was this page that was before chapter, I think it ends chapter 2. And it's this two-page spread, and so it shows the last Gene Pope kind of talking to the boy emperor as he's drifting off. And it's this beautiful two-page spread, and you see in the forefront in black and white the emperor, the boy emperor, like completely falling asleep, and this very innocent, you know, child sleeping. Mm-hmm. And in the background you see kind of the Gene Pope bent over and looking very insidious with this beautiful paint, like watercolor, I don't know what it is, in the background. And it just looks, as it bleeds off the page, you can see that it's not entering into the emperor's, you know, thoughts, that
right,
there's a difference. There's a schism there.
Yeah. I agree. Like I said, I mean, the book is designed so beautifully that almost any page gives you something to really look at and enjoy. One of my favorite pages, and again, talking about just the massive amounts of time that passed towards the end of this, I'm at the very, very end of the book. I don't know, about 3 or 4 pages from the end of the book. And it's a double page spread dealing with all of the invading armies and everything that kind of had to come together.
Oh, yeah.
Once everything was put back together again in the Empire, everything they had to deal with after that,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was kind of an interesting idea. And it's done so well. And it gives you an idea. Like I said, you talk about the world creation that was done. It's not just the... You know, he hasn't just designed the world of Rome or New Rome, and he hasn't just designed the world of 2054 or whatever. He's actually gone around and designed that whole world of New Rome and all the different areas about it, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you want to take a look at something design element, like, again, that I think was a really neat design thing, at the very end of chapter one, when Cardinal Pelle is assassinated.
Yeah, I thought that was a really cool page too.
He's assassinated, and Hickman goes out of his way to show there was four bullets. He numbers where the bullets hit, and it's
in what order,
and that is the way that one would cross themselves. So it would go from one down to two, over to three, or up and over to three, and then over to four, making the sign of the cross.
Uh-huh.
Which I thought was kind of a neat visual, but at the same time, it was a design element. And I thought, you know, it worked in that sense.
Yeah.
I thought it worked really well.
One thing that was really cool is that I yearn for, like, you know, Pax Romana 2, where it explains, you know, the part of the history where they just kind of jumped over. Or, you know, further on, like, I feel like there could be a second book to this.
I think there could be, you know...
A whole series,
there could
really
be a whole series, honestly, because there are... I mean, you could follow, once you get everyone splitting up into the three kingdoms, you could follow any of those three kingdoms. Like you said, there's massive jumps in time. And then, like I said, there's five pages of timeline at the end here, all of which have fascinating things happening, all of which would make for great fodder to
let alone the future, you know.
Yeah, let alone the future, which, again, I thought it was kind of interesting. The new emperor declares that we did it all by the year 1421, and I looked at the year 1421 to see if there was anything really, you know, fascinating about this year. And I don't know, maybe Hickman had something in mind with it. That was the year that, one theory has it, that China had completely mapped the world by that time. Oh. By the year 1421, China had sailed and discovered and charted the entire world by 1421. So to think, again, done it all. We've done it all. We've conquered everything by the year 1421. It's kind of a little, I don't know. Homage to, possibly. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's what Hickman had, or if he just drew it out of his head. I don't know.
Yeah.
To think that they had gone and colonized this new world of, you know, this new world, Mars, by, you know, 1421, you know, 70 years before, you know, Columbus, quote unquote, discovered.
Yeah.
You know, before he proved the new world, or showed the new world to Europe. I mean.
So how do you feel about the value of the book?
I feel pretty good about it. I mean, $14.99, I didn't feel like this was diluted Hickman. You and I went back and forth to Transhuman about how it was sold as a Hickman book, but the art just was not there.
It was substandard.
Yeah, and that while, you know, we got a different level of enjoyment out of that book, I enjoyed the story more than you enjoyed the story.
I felt like it fell apart somewhat towards the end.
Yeah, this one I felt like was a great story. There was so much here. It was paced well. And again, you got the Hickman art, so I felt like I was getting a full product. And at $15, I felt really good about it.
Yeah, this can sit right next to Nightly News and is right up there with it in quality.
This will be in front of Nightly News on my shelf. I just, like I said, some of the design elements are, you know, pushed aside, which, again, I liked. You know, I thought that the art, especially with the people, for as large of a cast as it was, you know, you had the handy players cards that go along with it, but also, like I said, he did a really nice job of keeping everybody unique.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a real testament to his ability to do something like that.
So next up, we've got Frankenstein's Womb by Warren Ellis and Marek Oleksicki.
Why not?
And this is, of course, about Frankenstein, but more it's about Mary Shelley and her creation of Frankenstein and her, more of like her biography, I would say.
Yeah, I really felt like what I was getting here was a biography of Mary Shelley and her life, couched in kind of the classic 1970s vault of horror where you've got the sort of creepy guy giving you a tour of the haunted house.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that that's paying enough.
I definitely think there is more to it than just that, but it had that feel to it. I know what you're saying. Because this was a thoroughly enjoyable, it was a thoroughly enjoyable way to read a biography.
Yes. I agree.
And a great twist on her story, really.
Right.
Because it's told by Frankenstein, her creation.
Right. So, I mean, the general plot of this is that in the year 1816, that Mary Shelley, or at the time Mary Goddard, or Godwin, Percy Shelley and Claire Claremont were traveling across Europe headed to Lake Geneva in Switzerland, where they were going to meet Lord Byron. And along the way in Germany, they stop at Castle Frankenstein, and Mary Shelley goes, or Mary Godwin goes in and has some sort of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Warren Ellis is trying to do here is fill in the details.
Because that actually happened.
Exactly.
This was a part of her life, and she stopped by Castle
Frankenstein
on her way, and then ends up writing a story, the story Frankenstein.
Right.
And so he kind of gives an explanation for where her inspiration came, while at the same time giving us a biography and really showing her importance to modernism, essentially. Right. She ushers in the modern age.
Agreed. It's a great twist and way to do this. It was a lot like one of Ellis's other apparat books, Creasy. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. There's actually an ad for it in the back. Where it is history and it's a story. And that's what I liked about this was that, yes, you're getting a biography, but you're getting something happening as well. And you're getting little bits and pieces, and they're kind of creepy, and they're kind of, I don't know, the whole thing puts you at ill ease while you're going through it.
Uh-huh. I'll tell you what, when I finished this book, I immediately got on the internet and started looking up all these different facts, not to fact check, but to really just kind of dig in. Like, more than anything, he really spurred my interest into Frankenstein, into Mary Shelley, into everything. Like, he just sort of throws out these tidbits of her life and shows just how interesting her life actually was and how important of a figure that she actually was.
Funny you should mention that, because I'm working on the annotations for this right now. They'll be up pretty soon. But no, I think that's really I think it's true. And the subtitle to the novel Frankenstein is the modern Prometheus. And Prometheus is the titan who not only gave birth to humanity, but also brought fire to humans. And if you look at that light, that inspiration, you know, you take it as a figurative light, you have in this the monster Frankenstein and this experience being her light and inspiration for the writing of the story Frankenstein. And like you said, Mary Shelley being an inspiration for this whole modern era of medicine and genetics and science and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of neat how that all plays together here, that she in herself becomes sort of a Prometheus, bringing fire.
Yeah.
Bringing this inspiration. But, you know, that's one of the things. It's hard to talk about this story without just giving a biography of her life, because everything that happens in here is taken directly from her life. And I think that's what's the most fascinating part of this, is that all of this, like you said, it wasn't about fact-checking. It was just about going and learning more. All this in here is true.
Yeah.
Assuming you believe the central conceit that she stopped and had this experience at Frankenstein Castle. And that's something that historians are still debating. Is it something that really happened? It's likely that she saw Frankenstein Castle, if not stopping and going in, then at least while on the Rhine River that she saw it. So, yeah, if you buy the central conceit that she stopped in, then wow, all this fascinating sort of what if story. What if it was this ghost story here?
That, yeah,
you know, all this happened, and
I don't really buy into the what if part of it, but I definitely buy in and into that this is an incredibly unique and an interesting way to present this story, and I just love the fact that it's her inspiration and her creation presenting her life story, not just in the future but also in the past. You know, it shows her mother dying, who died 9 days after she was born, and all of these different things, and takes her into the future, and really it parallels the age that she is bringing in or ushering in, mm-hmm. or at least marking in some way her place in this tidal wave that's coming of the modern age.
Right. You know, I think that for me, what sold this for me was the art. Was that as interesting as she was, and all these things that happened to her in her life, past, present, and future for her, the art sets the tone for the story in such a way that, you know, like I said, you feel the dark creepiness of this castle. You feel all of what's going on here, and without it being so over the top.
I agree 100%. The art is like a perfect marriage between the tone that the writer, Warren Ellis, is setting,
mm-hmm.
and the art just fully brings that out and fleshes that out, that tone and that creepiness that the story is trying to get across, that makes it actually interesting. Because if you don't feel creeped out at all, this could be a fairly boring book.
Right.
But exactly. It's that marriage between the tone, the story, and that idea that just brings this book together and really makes it pop.
It does. You know, and I struggle to decide what my favorite part of this, you know, my favorite panel in this book is. You know, part of me wants to say that it's this great one where we finally see the Frankenstein monster's face for the first time.
Yeah, and that was quite a startling page.
It's not your, you know, Boris Karloff, bolts young out the side of the head type thing. I mean, this is a much scarier, much more gruesome, dealing with the reality of the situation of what, you know, 19th century, stitching together dead bodies might produce.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that was the other thing, is I thought that for such a startlingly horrific creature, he portrayed a lot of emotion on the face. I mean, he was able to convey so much in that deformed face without losing what the face was looking like. Which was a real trick, because you can't make the face look like a regular face. It's got to look horrific, but yet still be able to show emotion or thought or, you know, memory.
My favorite panel is after Frankenstein takes her into the future, you get a full page spread of her on a skywalk overlooking a modern city. And then you turn the page, and the very top portion of the page is just her with her hands pressed against the glass, just this sort of horrified, awestruck kind of look that just says it all, you know. She would be absolutely horrified standing up above the ground with, you know, basically nothing underneath her. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, completely awestruck at, you know, just how modern everything is and the strangeness of it all.
Right. And you know what's kind of cool is at the bottom of that page, you've got the three doctors and then the person dying on the bed. And that page echoes this double page spread earlier on, where we see the birth of the Frankenstein monster. And that's what that's getting to what you were talking about this ushering into this modern age. The creation says that, you know, this is exactly what you talked about, bringing life to a dead body through the use of electricity. Well, they revived this man through the little paddles they stick on you and yell clear in all the in all the TV shows. But it's that same kind of idea, and I thought that was a great, not just having the monster say it, but also having that page echo so closely. The body positions are a little bit off. So a literalist will come through and go, no. But if you take a look at it, I mean, clearly the intent is there to have it be the same.
Yeah, there are so many. I mean, the art is just excellent throughout this. Like, I would be hard pressed to pick a panel that I didn't like or that was the worst. I mean, every page is just so detailed, and I really enjoyed the art. I'm really going to be looking for more work by this artist.
I agree that this is. This is the kind of art that you also would want to own.
Oh, definitely.
It's kind of got a Bernie Wrightson feel to it, but with heavier ink lines. And like I said, to have such a horrific face, but yet be able to show such a range of emotions without losing the horror of the situation is a real trick and a real treat to have this be this way. And, you know, the anatomy is spot on in this. And, you know, one of the first things that I always look at, it sounds so strange, but when you see horses, I always look at the feet and the legs of a horse because, you know, very famously the cover for Cowboys versus Aliens was this beautifully rendered horse until you got to its legs, at which point in time there were four little toothpicks. And, you know, we've talked about this with, like, elephants. Everybody's got, you know, a picture of an elephant in them or whatever. You know, everyone's got a picture of a horse, and it's usually about three quarters of a horse. And, I mean, you open with a double page spread of these four galloping horses and a coach crashing through a dark Germanic woods. And, I mean, it immediately sets the tone. You don't need to know anything else. I mean, you got the driver all bundled up, and you got the leaves, you know, the trees just have a few leaves clinging to them. So it's called the summer, it was called the year of no summer, or the year without a summer. And, you know, that kind of goes to sell the point as well, that even though it's supposed to be summertime, that what you've got here is something, you know, far darker and colder.
Mm-hmm.
Again, without having to harp on the fact that, you know, it was the year without summer.
Yeah, and that is an excellent two-page spread, and you can see the muscles in the horse.
Mm-hmm.
like the sternum. I mean, it's just amazing artwork, and yeah, it just continues from there on out.
And you know, I think that again, Warren Ellis has used this format very well. This is in that you know, apparat format that Etheric Mechanics was in and Creasy was in. It's just kind of a short 64 pages, 48 pages of story, but there isn't a wasted panel in here. Mm-hmm. There isn't a wasted page, and it's full and it's complete. Mm-hmm. It's not, like you said, you were left wanting more, but you weren't left wanting more from this story. You were left wanting more about Mary Shelley and to learn more about Frankenstein and to learn more about
About that age. Like, he really brings to life the age with the other characters that are involved in her life. And so I really wanted to know about that time period. Like, he really interested me in not just her life, but that whole time period.
Right. And that, I mean, I can't think of something that would be any better than that, to have a piece that you put down and you can't stop thinking about, that you've got to go and get more and more and more about. And that's, I mean, really high praise for that. And it's $6.99. You know, what a steal. Really, it's $6.99. Fantastic art. Great story.
Really is. I mean, I want to go pick up another one and cut out the pages and frame them. I mean,
right.
They're just beautiful.
They really are.
Great on a wall. I mean, they're just awesome.
Well, and, you know, looking back at your favorite, you know, panel here, it's, you know, Mary Godwin is beautiful in this. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially when you put her next to this horrific monster. And, you know, Percy Shelley, her soon-to-be husband, I mean, he's kind of handsome, but the fact that he's a dick comes through too, you know, not just in his words, but in the way he's drawn. And then you've got, the sister, Claire Claremont, who, you know, she's pregnant and yet there's a, you know, she's kind of ugly at times, but it's ugly in the sense that she's going through a pretty horrific ordeal here, you know? She's mm-hmm. not played for comedic effect. She's not played, you know, to be this horrific beast, even though Percy sees her as a huge inconvenience.
Yeah.
So the characters are drawn well, they're portrayed well, and they hint at, like you said, a bigger story. There's a lot more here than can be contained in this little book.
Yeah, he really just kind of throws out tidbits of what goes on in her life.
Yeah,
and I mean, I was really interested.
Reading the whole thing about, I mean, like you said, going back and sort of figuring out, I mean, reading the whole thing about why they're even on this trip.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, we could spend a whole podcast just discussing why they're on this trip and, you know, where her other children are and where these children came from. I mean, there's all these pieces in here. And like I said, we'll have the annotations up so that if people don't want to go and do tons of research on their own, they can read our annotations on it. But like I said, I mean, it's fascinating stuff that reading this makes you want to go and get more.
Yeah, and we haven't even touched on Johann Dippel, who, I mean, was an alchemist, like one of the first alchemists, and he has a totally interesting story as well that's just kind of brought up and brushed aside really quickly. I mean, there is so much in this story to really catch your interest in and make you want to seek more and understand more about it.
You know, the best lies have a nugget of truth buried in them. You know, and fiction is a really great lie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is. I mean, this whole piece of fiction is based around a couple of really solid nuggets of truth. Mm-hmm. There really is a Castle Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's called. There really was a guy named, you know, Johann Dippel who lived there. And like you said, he was an alchemist and he was an outcast. And he signed his name a couple of times, you know, Frankenstonian or Frankensteinist or whatever. Frankenstein. says, yeah, I'm not even going to attempt it, but it basically means born of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
I mean, all these things really happened. And so you've got this central conceit. You've got all these things that really, really happened. Why don't I just throw in one more little thing?
Yeah.
Just a little thing. Because you're already bit. You're already like, okay, you know, there really is a Castle Frankenstein. Wow, there really was this guy. What else?
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier to accept it. And I think that Ellis played it brilliantly.
Yeah, it was a really great book. Really enjoyable.
Enjoyable.
Well, you have been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. Visit us at StumptownTradeReview.com.